Welcome to Oncology Today, Novel Agents and Strategies in Ovarian Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Deborah Richardson from the OU Health Stevenson Cancer Center in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Richardson's slide presentation. To begin, she commented on recently presented data from the DESTINY Pan-Tumor02 study of trastuzumab deruxtecan in patients with a variety of HER2-expressing solid tumors.
I'm still enthusiastic about antibody-drug conjugates. I think that, you know, we only have one so far. I think that's a large, you know, potential. And I kind of briefly mentioned that last case, with HER2-new or ERBB2. There isn't that much high expression, but now with more potent antibody drug conjugates, we're seeing efficacy. And so one of the most exciting things to me was the DESTINY trial at ASCO, where that was the basket trial, you know, and you could be 1+, 2+, 3+ HER2. And we actually saw the highest response rates in, you know, mostly in the GYN cancers, including ovarian cancer. So I think TDXD might have a role for those patients potentially as well. As far as other treatments, I'm curious to see how the relacorilant is going to do. There's also nemvaleukin. So that's where we're looking at the kind of novel immunotherapy trial. There definitely are some bispecifics that may be exciting as well. You know, we have not figured out how to harvest the immune system for ovarian cancer. And to me, that's like the biggest thing we need to figure out. How do we get patients with ovary cancer to get an immunologic response? How can we see some of the responses that we've seen in uterine cancer and cervix cancer? And of course, melanoma, you know, many other solid tumors. We just have not been successful with immunotherapy and ovary cancer. So I'd really love to see us figure that out and bring some of those therapies forward for our patients.
You mentioned a TDXD and, of course, now being used in HER2-low breast cancer. And as you say, now we're starting to see responses in many different places, including the data from ASCO. Have you actually used it in any patients with gynecologic cancers?
I have not given TDXD, but I've given a similar ADC in our phase one unit to endometrial cancers. We have an ongoing phase one trial right now enrolling endometrial cancer. And I would say just about every patient we put on that trial has had a PR. Not everyone, but the majority. But
yeah,
I
heard a couple of, I think about a year ago, a couple of oncologists in community practice who had tried it in gynecologic cancers, and they saw responses. Of course, they have a lot of experience from breast, now lung, and GI cancers. And you mentioned a couple of times the issue of ILD in some of the antibody-drug conjugates that you were talking about. And of course, that's been a big issue with TDXD. The breast cancer people are very aggressive about looking for ILD. They do preemptive imaging on these patients frequently, although it doesn't seem like, you know, lung and GI does it quite as much. Any thoughts about how you're going to approach screening for ILD if and when you see a patient you're able to use TDXD?
I mean, I would definitely use CT chest, and I would probably do it every 3 cycles. You know, with my CAT scan, abdomen, pelvis. That's typically how I manage my patients, and standard of care is 3 cycles and then image, and certainly have a low threshold if they're having any symptoms to get a CT scan of the chest. I think the good news is GYN oncologists have become more familiar with pneumonitis and recognizing it and diagnosing it. It was not something we had to worry about very much until recently.
Hey, we didn't have to worry about ophthalmic issues until fairly recently. We did an entire CME program just on ophthalmologic complications of oncology drugs, believe it or not. I never thought we would do that. Let me ask you something else, and you know, maybe you're going to tell me that this is something that's going by as well, but I was just kind of curious. I saw in your CV some work you're doing on prexasertib. It has a bunch of letters and names there. It sounds kind of interesting. What exactly is it?
It inhibits CHK1/2. So basically cell cycle inhibition, you know, so kind of thinking about other cell cycle inhibitors. So we're trying to develop the drug.
Have you seen any responses with it?
We have. It's usually given in combination with something else and not a single agent.
Right. So another thing you commented on in your talk was Tumor Treating Fields, which, as you mentioned, unfortunately, just saw a press release that in terms of the primary endpoints or survival, that it's not going to be adequate. Any thoughts about that strategy? I guess it's maybe not going to go too far. I guess in ovarian cancer, there was a positive phase 3 trial presented at ASCO in lung, although there it was only effective when used with immunotherapy. Any thoughts about this strategy and whether or not you see any future for it?
So I think we only have seen the top line data that it failed to meet its primary endpoint in ovarian cancer. So I think we need a lot more data to kind of break it down. You know, is there a subgroup that potentially benefits, et cetera? I feel like we see this a lot in phase 3 trials where the phase 2 or, you know, phase 1s look very promising. And the later phase we get, the less response rates we see and the worse median progression-free and overall survival. But perhaps if it works better with immunotherapy and lung cancer, is there some kind of strategy there in ovary cancer? Quite frankly, at least standard checkpoint inhibitors don't work very well in ovarian cancer. So it may not be with IO by itself, or at least a checkpoint inhibitor, but what about a bispecific? You know, so if you could get a bispecific potentially with an anti-angiogenic plus something that targets anti-PD-1 or one of the other receptors that we could think about, TIGIT, things like that. I think we just have not figured out how to harvest the immune system and first of all, we need to alter the tumor microenvironment for ovarian cancer. And then we've got to get the, you know, T lymphocytes to kill the ovarian cancer. That strategy has not been very easy to figure out in ovarian cancer. But there may be some kind of bispecific or something else out there that's novel that will work maybe in combination with something else. And what's nice about the tumor treatment fields is, you know, there's some derm side effects, but otherwise it seems to be, and I think it's probably a little bulky, right? People have to wear them, I believe, 22 out of 24 hours a day. But compared to some other side effects of systemic treatments we give, that's not so bad. So I don't know if there will be a way forward for tumor treatment fields in ovarian cancer. But perhaps, you know, depending on what the company finds, there may be some novel combinations to consider there.
Yeah, we actually had a couple of patients who were on that trial that we had presented. I think it was at SGO, and they... As you said, the main issue there was dermatologic, you know, the leads causing dermatologic issues that once you stop it, they kind of go away. So other than convenience, it seems like it was tolerated very well. Let me ask you another question. Somebody asked me something. I haven't heard about this drug in a long time, and it was asking me about this in ovarian. I was like, I don't know. Ixabibulone.
Ah, so that that now made it.
I think I remember hearing that when I was a fellow or something. I don't know. I was like, where did that come from?
Yeah, I feel like ixabibulone is on the NCCN compendia. I feel like we used it actually in uterine cancer in GOG86P. I have actually never given that drug because the patients I enrolled on that trial did not get randomized to that arm. But recently we did talk about it briefly at a symposium at SGO, but I have no experience using ixabibulone. It is now, I believe, compendia listed.
And do you know anything about it? Is it used as a single agent or
it is single agent. I would have to look it up, honestly. There's okay. So many options that are out there. And I, for the most part here, we put so many patients on clinical trial. I don't usually get to that line of therapy where I have to use something that I haven't used before in ovary cancer.
Another thing I saw on your CV that, again, I don't know how much interest you have or experience, but I just, given the carboplatin shortage, I noticed that you had this study looking at carboplatin clearance predictors.
So that's, it's an NRG study. And the thing is, we don't really know how to dose carboplatin. We just dose it as this area under the curve. So it's unclear what doses are we actually giving the patients? Are we giving them what we intend to give them? It's never been systematically looked at. And so it's enrolling both men and women. It's actually closed to women enrolling because there's enough women. So trying to enroll men now, male patients. But the way that carbo is calculated is using a GFR, you know, and their creatinine, et cetera. And so we just want to know, are patients actually getting what we think they're getting, or is there variation? If there's variation, how much? And is this the, what's the best way to dose carboplatin?
Any comments? Of course, at ASCO, that was, we did 10 programs on different kinds of cancers. Almost every one, people were bringing up the chemo shortage, and GYN cancers was a hot, way up on the list of concerns. I'm curious at your place what the situation is and what advice you give to practitioners who can't access carbo. And I've even heard not even be able to get cisplatin sometimes. But what advice do you give people, or what are you doing yourself? What's the situation where you are?
Yeah, I mean, it's been actually pretty terrible. I never anticipated having these barriers as an oncologist of having shortages of drugs that potentially are curative intent. We did have a shortage of carboplatin. I'm happy to say that we have actually resolved that shortage, and we've been able to remove the brakes from using carboplatin here, because for a while we had it very restricted. We also do have some cisplatin shortage, though again, we're able to dose patients. I will say the SGO came out with some guidance, so did ASCO. So one of my recommendations to practitioners is looking to that ASCO guidance and the SGO guidance, because, you know, basically kind of broke down what are the alternatives, what are other regimens you can use. So oxaliplatin is an option as a third platinum. We do have some data in GYN cancers, though not a lot. And it does have a little bit different side effect profile, has potentially some more neuropathy, but that is an option. And then just working with your pharmacists, and there actually has been some help from the SGO as far as advocacy, but also reaching out. There's some organizations that were able to procure some platinum, some carbo, and some cisplatin. So I actually did reach out to the SGO president, Dr. Angela Secord, who put our institution in contact with some of these organizations, and then Dr. Amanda Nichols-Fader as well. Both of them have some contacts if places are really struggling. There are places that seem to have good supplies, and so some people have sent their patients to some of the bigger academic centers that seem to have adequate supplies. What we were doing here was trying to be fair. Anybody who was curative intent, we were trying to save the, you know, carboplatin or cisplatin, depending on what regimen they were getting, depending on what their disease was. So for ovary, it would obviously be carbo. We did try and keep everybody with curative intent on carboplatin. We did dose reduce. So we took everybody down an AUC level. So if they were on 6, we went to 5. If they were on 5, we went to 4. We didn't go below 4. But we did try and conserve what we had as much as possible. And we're upfront with patients about shortages, and that we end up signing consents for carboplatin or cisplatin.
Yeah, I hear these stories all the time of, you know, talking about, you know, using it in curative situations, not curative. I just can't imagine discussing that with a patient.
It's awful.
Particularly somebody who to be able to essentially communicate the idea that because you have metastatic disease, we're not going to be able to give you the treatment that we normally use. I just can't even imagine how patients must feel and how physicians feel in that situation.
Yeah, it's been one of the hardest things I think I've had to deal with in my career, quite frankly, because it was very frustrating. And all I can hope is that our Congress can, you know, pass some legislation that would make sure these kinds of things don't continue to happen. Because, you know, if I'm not mistaken, there's over 15 drugs that are chemotherapies that are on the list. Even Taxol is potentially at risk of being in shortage.
I'm curious, too, what your thoughts are in terms of next steps in terms of PARP inhibitors, in terms of new approaches, new thoughts, PARP after PARP, mechanisms of PARP resistance. Any thoughts or any research going on that has you interested and optimistic?
I mean, I think you just hit them. You know, who should we use PARP in after PARP? We have minimal data. There was the OREO trial, and it didn't look great, in my opinion, as far as reusing PARP maintenance on patients who had had prior PARP maintenance. However, I'm sure that there are some patients who are going to benefit, and I would really like to be able to know who they are. I can imagine if I had a BRCA patient who, you know, completed their PARP maintenance, had a long disease-free interval, recurs, and is platinum sensitive, and I'm going to re-challenge them with platinum, that I would want to use a PARP inhibitor again. So I think there are going to be those patients. I think, you know, we have to, this is where there's some novel trial designs coming out, trying to identify, this is where I'm hoping we move to maybe circulating tumor DNA. That's not something that's really used much in GYN cancers at this point, and we don't have a lot of data, but I could see that being very helpful for to answer these questions. You know, do patients, have they developed BRCA reversion mutations? But what we know about PARP inhibitors are that the number one thing that predicts their sensitivity after you get off to frontline, and they're, you know, if obviously if they're BRCA mutated, but after that, if they're platinum sensitive, that predicts potentially being sensitive to a PARP inhibitor, unless of course they progressed on a PARP inhibitor. Some of those patients are still platinum sensitive because the mechanism of resistance are not the same. But how do we identify who could do PARP alone? Who needs a PARP combo? And are there PARP combos that we can give that, number one, the drugs can be combined without overlapping toxicity and, you know, potentially restore PARP sensitivity? I'm very interested in those, you know, questions, and there are some smart people in our field working on those questions, and there are some hopefully trials coming to try and answer some of that. You know, it could be a ATR inhibitor in combination with PARP. I think it may depend on what is your PARP resistance, you know, mechanism. We don't know what those are yet. You know, we don't have a way clinically of knowing why was this person resistant to PARP, but hopefully we're going to get there.
You know, I heard about these reversion mutations. What's your vision of what that is?
So they revert back to BRCA function. You know, so you can have inherited or somatic mutations, and then they revert back. And so now they are no longer homologous recombination deficient. They can repair their DNA through that pathway.
And this could occur theoretically in people with germline mutations as well?
It does happen. It's not common, but it definitely can happen, and the tumor can be under, you know, pressure to develop a reversion mutation, both from platinum and from PARP inhibitors.
You know, it's funny. Just as you were mentioning cell-free DNA, I was writing it down here as a note to ask you about, because, and like you said, in other solid tumors, you know, nonstop when we do webinars, everybody's asking about cell-free DNA. Is it being looked at all in gynecologic cancer? Is there any reason it wouldn't be appropriate?
I think it is being looked at. We just have limited data. So I would like to see a lot more, you know, developed. And there's different companies that offer it. I certainly have sent it from time to time. In general, I think a lot of times for ovary cancer, we have plenty of tissue, especially if somebody has an upfront debulking. So we tend to prefer tumor. Where I see it, you know, being useful is kind of, especially if you could follow it like over time, right? That's where cell-free DNA would be very interesting. Like, first of all, you have your tumor and you have those mutations, and maybe you check the blood at the same time, make sure you can identify them, and then you follow it over time. Because some patients maybe are going to have minimal residual disease. Now, that may help you decide, should you give maintenance, should you not give maintenance, right? What if they have no residual? Do they need maintenance at all? But I need to be able to do something with that information. It has to be actionable. I kind of have a rule that don't order a test if you can't do anything with the information. And so right now, I just don't know how to counsel patients. There are some patients that push for it. They want to know. But for example, back in the day for ovary cancer, we used to do these second look surgeries. And well, we found disease all the time, but it didn't help people live longer. We just detected their disease sooner. So what I need is then effective strategies for maintenance or other things that are going to actually lead to improvements in both overall survival and quality of life. I don't want to just be diagnosing things and subjecting patients to more treatment, but not improving their outcomes.
Any trials out there, particularly larger trials, not necessarily looking at new agents, but in ovarian cancer that you think either from a, you know, research point of view or even, you know, patient care today point of view, you think are worth commenting on?
Well, I'm very curious to see what the outcome of the first trial is going to be. That was an upfront trial where it's closed to enrollment, but patients got IO with chemotherapy. And there were several trials like this. And then they got everybody got niraparib maintenance with or without IO. So I'm curious. That's a strategy that I'm curious about. Will IO work that way? It was a checkpoint inhibitor. So that definitely our frontline trials that have kind of complete enrollment, but we don't have results on. That's going to be very curious to me. And I think we touched on some of the other big phase three trials that are ongoing, nemvaleukin, relacorilant. It's hard to make improvements in ovarian cancer. I am excited about, you know, the potential of taking some of these antibody drug conjugates and developing them and potentially replacing some of the doublet chemotherapies we use. Are we going to make, you know, forward impact that way? You know, I think we have lots of room to improve. We have lots of unmet need. We really need to do something better about maintenance for those HRP patients up front. You know, those are patients that do not do well.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot today. Really interesting. Sorry to hear about UPRI. I hope it comes back at some point. It must be really terribly disappointing.
It was. You know, I was the national PI of Uplift and the international PI of UpNext. So, yeah, I've been treating patients since the first in human and, you know, was really hopeful about that drug. So we'll find out. More to learn.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Richardson, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.